Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, December the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, at a hearing in Washington, Democrats and Republicans lay out sharply diverging views on impeaching President Donald Trump.
President Trump put himself before country.
At the end of the day, your case isn't made.
The latest on a deadly volcanic eruption in New Zealand. Also ahead, singer Billie Eilish is keeping it real as she opens up about her body image insecurities. It's all on today's International Edition. A U.S. House of Representatives impeachment hearing quickly fell into partisan fighting. On Monday, as lawmakers formally received the investigative findings against President Trump to lay out the case for charges against him. The committee's Democratic chairman, Representative Gerald Nadler, said there is extensive proof of Trump's wrongdoing.
The debates around the framing make clear that the most serious of such offenses include abuse of power, betrayal of the nation through foreign entanglements, and corruption of public office. Any one of these violations of the public trust would compel the members of this committee to take action. When combined in a single course of action, they state the strongest possible case for impeachment and removal from office.
Nadler said in his closing statement that the danger to our democracy is real, but Representative Doug Collins, the top Republican on the panel, argued that Democrats are on a politically driven mission to remove Trump from office without direct evidence that he committed impeachable offenses.
I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment. Because we don't have a crime, we don't have anything we can actually pin, and nobody understands really what the majority is trying to do. Except that interfere and basically make sure that they believe the president can't win next year if he's impeached.
Well, the roughly 9-hour hearing in the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee was punctuated by shouting and recriminations from Trump's fellow Republicans, unhappy with the process that could lead the panel to vote as soon as tomorrow on articles of impeachment. Joining us now to talk more about it, live from Minneapolis, Minnesota, is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Thanks so much for being with us, as always.
Great to be with you again.
So what exactly was the goal of this latest hearing? Because it sort of was unclear to me, anyway.
Oh, no question about it. When I was watching this is what I thought of. These were closing arguments. The idea was to make, at least from the Democrats' standpoint, is they wanted a cohesive argument that you could really get a tight understanding to drive the American people, and ideally to drive a few more Republicans, maybe any Republicans, to stand up and say, yeah, there may be something here. That was the intent. I think if you look at what the Republicans were doing, is they were throwing sand in the works. Their job was to make the Democrats look confused, make the Democrats look weak, make the Democrats look like what they were really trying to do was to overturn, and this is the language they used, overturn 63 million votes. And they pushed that point again and again, and I think that was their point. That's what they were trying to do.
But there were no witnesses. It was just basically attorneys, the lawmakers interviewing attorneys on both sides. Why was that?
Well, and again, the reason that you would see before, and if you go back and look at the intelligence committee's work previously, and then you looked at some of the experts. The whole concept originally was to say, let's take a look at some of the individuals who are involved. So you think of the likes of Ambassador Sondland as one example. And those are specific people with specific pieces of information.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you brought in next was you brought in the experts to say, this is the standard that one would apply. So you can think about what that standard would be looking at the facts that were presented. The idea today was to get one individual to come in and weave those around each other to create a compelling narrative to convince people that their side is right. So this was a specifically adversarial system that argued what the facts were, argued what the law was, and where we should go next. And they were fighting on both sides of that.
Did anything new come out of it, or were there any big takeaways?
Well, I think the real frustrating part for some people was that what we would all hope for is that there would at least be an agreement as to what the facts were. or at least, how about this? At least there was an agreement as to what the standard of law that would apply. So you can say, now we'll decide which side of the law one is on with all the proof that's presented. But what I found was, I think the Republicans were somewhat successful at laying out a very confusing narrative that made some people scratch their heads. And I think that may have had some traction. You certainly saw it in the room.
So what's next?
Well, I think what we expect to see is this, is the Judiciary Committee is going to draft several articles of impeachment. And as I understand, what we may be looking at right now is one specifically on the abuse of power, the other on obstruction of Congress. There's been a real debate on this issue on whether or not the Democrats are going to go broad. So in other words, add things like from the Mueller investigation and inferences to what was going on with the Russians in the first place, and maybe even obstruction in that sense. And something more narrow, specifically the abuse of power when it comes to Ukraine on the one side and how the president has stopped people from helping and stopped them from testifying when they were compelled to do so. So those are really narrow right now. I expect to see a determination this week from the Judiciary Committee. This will go to the House, the whole House for a vote by the end of next week because they're going to break for Christmas. So I expect to see within the next probably 8 or 9 days, we're going to actually have a president that will have been impeached. It will then go to the Senate for a determination and an actual trial.
Okay. So we know that even though you're saying trial, really this is a political process. It's not a legal process. But if it were a legal trial, how would things be going for each side?
I think that the Democrats laid out a compelling case. And if you look at what the experts said, the experts were all almost unilaterally not just concerned, but they saw this as catastrophic. And if you think about what some of the experts were saying, is they were really making this argument, is that you can't have a president making foreign policy that's designed specifically to help him in his own political campaign, because it undercuts the very concept of what the United States does. It undercuts the very concept of what rule of law means. What the Republicans have tried to do and have done effectively is to make the argument that this is really political. This is about trying to take away a 2016 election from the rightful winner. And that's the argument that they have been making. They both are making points. The problem is that you need a two-thirds majority in the U.S. Senate in order to actually remove President Trump from office. And at least as of right now, the Dems don't have it. They don't.
Okay. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, we always appreciate your perspective. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, French President Emmanuel Macron, along with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, say there was goodwill and progress at a summit in Paris Monday aimed at advancing efforts to restore peace to eastern Ukraine, though much work remains to be done. The two mediated the talks where Russian President Vladimir Putin met his Ukrainian counterpart for the first time. The first meeting between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin failed to find a compromise to end the five-year-old war that's killed 14,000 people, emboldened the Kremlin, and reshaped European geopolitics. Joining us for that story to talk more about it is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, sounds like it was at least a start.
Ukrainian president and his Russian counterpart meeting for at least an hour, just the two of them there. So that was important, the fact that these two men have now met. All the agreements which came beyond that, you know, were a step in the right direction. Nobody had expected, you know, an enormous step forward, but everyone was just so pleased, particularly the French, that this meeting got underway. Everyone played their part. No crockery was broken. Nobody walked out, went home early. And at the end, they issued this communique, which sets out a road ahead for the next few months and a way to attempt to de-escalate the conflict in eastern Ukraine.
Well, it sounds like Zelensky still enjoys broad public support, but of course he's been very embarrassed, put in a very difficult situation for a brand new politician, much less a brand new leader of a country, by the scandals surrounding his discussions with U.S. President Donald Trump. Did that play any factor in any of it, or was it really just kept on the straight and narrow as far as the issues between Ukraine and Russia?
It was just on Ukraine, Russia, and the conflict in eastern Ukraine. I mean, certainly the Ukrainian president is in a lot of trouble, and that is because at home his electorate does not want him to give way to Russia on anything. And let's have to remember that he was elected to office earlier this year. He got 73% of the vote, and his big push then was that he was going to bring an end to the conflict. So, in fact, when they were speaking to the press afterwards, the Ukrainian president said that there were still red lines there. He said that there will be no federalization of Ukraine, meaning that each part of Ukraine would have the same rights. He also said that no one would influence the development or the future political role of Ukraine. And he also said that Donbas and Crimea are still part of Ukraine. And that clearly is meant for his home audience. And then just flip over 5 minutes later and you've got the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, talking completely the opposite. He's saying that they do need to have some sort of situation whereby the Donbas region has its own special status. And he's also talking about there can be none of this big Western influence in Ukraine. That is another of the Russian red lines. It has got to stick very clearly with what Russia wants. None of this moving into the Western economic and military zone, if you like. Behind the scenes, there's been a lot of diplomatic activity has been going on for the last few months just to get these talks happening. And those talks didn't just involve Germany, France, Russia and Ukraine. There is a lot of movement and a lot of talk going on between diplomats from pretty much the whole of NATO wanting to see an end to this conflict in the Ukraine. So the Ukrainians are doing the best they can with a very difficult hand, knowing full well, of course, that the French and the Germans do want to have Russia back in, if you like, in from the cold. They want to be dealing with Russia again. They want an end to the sanctions.
What can we expect going forward? Is it really just more of the same and this was all sort of just an introduction for the two? Or do you think there's anything tangible that could come out of this?
The actual tangible results are very minimal, but they are, if you like, sort of steps towards having a dialogue and trying to get some sort of confidence moving between the two sides. So we are going to see, if this goes according to plan, there will be an exchange of prisoners by the end of the year. We're not sure how many that will be, but we do know there's some 250 Ukrainians in Russian prisons or in custody in parts of eastern Ukraine that have got the Russian controlled. So we're going to see that. It's going to be the International Red Cross who's going to be put in charge of making sure that happens. Hopefully, they say there will be a ceasefire by the end of 2019. And again, we're looking at the possibility of a withdrawal of forces and equipment from three specific conflict zones by March 2020. So if they can get that done, then yes, something concrete will have come out of these talks. But as the Ukrainian president said before he left, since he's been in office, there have been 20 ceasefires. There have been 20 ceasefire violations. So he's not that confident. But again, they had to come up with something. And if these small measures go, then there will be some sort of consolidation. And even at the end of the day, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said that the meeting was, and I'm quoting here, an important step to de-escalation.
All right. That is Catherine Field. She is a reporter joining us from Paris. Thank you. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. President Trump and the Saudi Crown Prince are vowing cooperation in the probe into the naval base shooting in the U.S. Kenya's World Heritage town is worrying development will dilute its culture. Russia is banned from competition for 4 years over continuing its doping scandal, or a continuing doping scandal. And U.S. border apprehensions have dropped for a sixth straight month. find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A deadly volcanic eruption Tuesday covered a small New Zealand island popular with tourists in hot ash and steam, killing at least five people. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says that while eight people are still missing after the eruption on White Island, officials don't believe there are any survivors.
The Police Eagle helicopter, rescue helicopter and NZDF aircraft have undertaken a number of aerial reconnaissance flights over the island since the eruption. No signs of life have been seen at any point.
Well, an eyewitness detailed horrific burns suffered by survivors. Joining us now to talk more about this is Dr. Richard Arculus, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University. Thank you for being with us, Professor. So why was there no warning that this was about to erupt?
Really good question, because people wouldn't have been there, being taken by tour operators who rely on the volcano experts in New Zealand telling them what the alert level is, if there'd been any foreseen problem. Because volcanologists are really good these days about predicting volcano eruptions. White Island's interesting, and it's not alone, in that you're looking at the top end, a crater sat on the top of a 1,500-meter-high structure, most of which is underwater, so it's surrounded by sea. And also falling on the island is rainfall, and you get a combination of seawater coming into the structure and rainfall into the crater. So you've got groundwater essentially lying around and permeating the crust. And when magma rises into the crust, there are some very interesting, so it's fascinating for geologists, very interesting interactions between the magma and the gases which are coming out of it and the groundwater. You get a kind of series of mineral reactions, a bit like carbon sequestration. If you pump CO2 into the ground, it will react with minerals in the rock and form a calcium carbonate and basically be sealed and stored underground. So we're looking at a kind of equivalent process, but a natural one. And the products of those reactions can end up forming quite an impermeable seal to the magma chamber. So you're putting a sort of cap on it. If that cap gets breached through some process, structural failure of the volcano or whatever, and the groundwater get direct access to the magma, that's an explosive combination, and it's a result of failure of the volcano structure. And that can't be predicted. It's like a mechanical engineering problem. There's no forewarns, no signs that it's going to happen. Fails, and then bang, off it goes. You recall last year when the end of the Hawaiian eruption was happening and the lava flows were reaching to the sea. Hawaiian magmas are very different from these Ring of Fire volcanoes. They intrinsically have low dissolved volatiles, and therefore they flow like lavas, coherent streams. When it reached the sea, there were tour operators taking people, and I would have been on one of those boats saying, get closer, closer. I want to see the picture of the lava entering the water. And one tour boat got too close, and there was an explosion of the lava interacting with the seawater, and a lump of rock came across and hit somebody on the boat. So that's kind of an analogy to what was going on here. So there are no forewarning signs. It just suddenly there's a failure of some kind, direct ingress of the groundwater into the magma system, and it explodes.
Potentially, could it still erupt more?
Yes, I don't say so. The official websites about volcano alerts is saying there's a possibility of an eruption of the same size. Extremely unlikely would be anything bigger, but it certainly is no. There's no guarantee that it's just stopped and that's the end of it. So I think there'll be a holding off of all kinds of tours, except visits by experts, recovery of equipment. There'll be a lot of examination of the material that was dumped out of the volcano, because geologists are good at forensically exploring, well, what is the record in the material that's thrown out? Can we unravel what happened? So there'll be people going there for a while. No doubt there'll be a coroner. And once all of that settled down, it's a question of whether people will be allowed back under toward supervision.
That is Dr. Richard Arculus, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University. A crater rim camera owned and operated by New Zealand's Geological Hazards Agency showed one group of people walking away from the rim inside the crater just 1 minute before the explosion. Tourists from Australia, the U.S., Britain, China, and Malaysia are among the missing and injured, along with New Zealanders. Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, speaking at a news conference, says the UN climate meeting in Madrid needs to hear from young activists and native cultures from regions where climate change is very real.
It is the people especially from the global south and from indigenous communities who need to tell their stories.
She said there's no time to waste. Climate change is already here. Thunberg spoke as Amnesty International released the results of a new survey that more than 10,000 young people in 22 countries found climate change ranks highest as their vital issue of our time. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Kenya's remote island of Lamu, with a UNESCO World Heritage Site that dates back to the 14th century, is under threat, according to activists. Authorities are constructing a major port and oil pipeline transport links, and they hope to build the region's first coal-fired power plant. While the infrastructure would boost the local economy, some residents worry the development and a flood of outsiders will dilute the unique local culture and architecture, which some say is already falling apart. Ruud Ellendorf reports from Lamu.
The remoteness of Kenya's Lamu Island has helped maintain its 650-year-old Swahili culture and traditions. Cars are banned in Lamu Town, a UN World Heritage Site, so donkeys are the main mode of transport. But some locals worry construction of a new port, oil pipeline and transport links on the mainland will bring more outsiders to settle in Lamu and change the unique culture.
We are trying our best to prevent that kind of intervention or sort of the kind of new development so that we can preserve the Lamu.
Authorities say the $26 billion group of projects will improve economic links between Kenya, South Sudan and Ethiopia and create thousands of jobs. But a Kenyan court in June halted construction of a coal-fired power plant that was to help fuel the projects, encouraging opponents.
We as Lamu people are afraid because when people come from other areas, they come with many things. Their own language, their own culture, I mean their own way of living. And this might alter the cultural way that people have been living.
Fishermen who are concerned about the impact on their catch oppose the port construction.
How they have done outside is terrible. To break all the rock where we support go to fishing, we cannot anymore. So when the time of the season it's finished, it's a rain season. You can't go anywhere to fishing now.
Activists worry the projects could also thwart efforts to preserve Lamu Town and its unique character. More than a third of Lamu's historic buildings are already falling apart, says the National Museums of Kenya.
Some of the owners do not want to any kind of intervention. They think perhaps by putting money into their building, perhaps you are actually owning it. You are taking over that particular building. So it's a very complex kind of thing.
Lamu authorities vow they will protect the island's world heritage from the projects.
We have also put measures to ensure that the LAPSET activities will remain on the mainland of Lamu. That is Hindi area, Mokowe and the likes. And that's the Lamu Archipelago, that is Lamu Island, starting from Shela all the way to Kipungani, remains with its status of heritage.
Lamu authorities say they are organizing funds to help renovate historic buildings and develop the economy with tourism as a major pillar. At the risk of commercializing their culture, some argue bringing in more tourists may actually help keep Lamu's unique traditions alive. Ruth Almendorf for VOA News, Lamu, Kenya.
Well, it has been quite a year for singer Billie Eilish as her first album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, made one of the biggest debuts in music history. But in an interview with CBS's Gayle King, Eilish revealed some very personal things, including her struggles over the past year.
I was so unhappy last year, and even the beginning of this year, I was so unhappy, and I was so, like, joyless. There were so many reasons. It all was because I was actually clinically depressed. That was the beginning of it. But then on top of it was this fame that I didn't want at the time. It was this inability to go out places, and it was so torturous, was because all I wanted to do was go hang out with my friends. The depression was the hardest part of all this.
Well, Eilish says she is now a whole lot better.
Kind of coming out of it for the last, like, 6 months, actually, which feels like that to me. But it's, like, the most freeing feeling to be able to come out of that shell.
Eilish also talked about why she always wears baggy clothing on stage.
Me and my body's relationship has been the most toxic relationship you could even imagine.
For most women, it is.
I know. The way that I dress has made that relationship so much better. It's less about my body is ugly, I don't want you to see it. It's more like, I'm not comfortable wearing this. I'm comfortable wearing this. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean physically, literally, like, feel soft.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like, your mental comfort.
Well, her number one hit song, Bad Guy, won 4 Grammy Awards. And Eilish also won the Grammy for Best New Artist. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Trump administration and the United States Congress are currently in discussions regarding a proposal to create and fund a service branch within the U.S. Air Force that would assist in deterring conflict in space. Called the United States Space Force, the branch would be part of the U.S. Air Force, much of the way the Marine Corps are part of the U.S. Navy. Over time, the Space Force would evolve to become a standalone branch of the armed services. Scott Pace is Executive Secretary of the National Space Council. He explained why space is now considered what the Pentagon calls a warfighting domain.
Some people say, are we going to militarize space? And the answer is space has really been a military domain since the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. They used a converted ICBM to do it. So space has been a realm of military activity really since the very beginning. It's been used for reconnaissance, it's been used for communications, it's used for navigation. What space has not been has been a warfighting domain. And what's become different in the last few years, ever since the 2007 anti-satellite test that China conducted, where they destroyed one of their own weather satellites, we've seen a rapid and steady growth in anti-satellite weapons by Russia and China. China and Russia have, of course, observed how dependent we are on space for our military activities, and therefore they've been building weapon systems to place those capabilities at risk.
Executive Secretary Pace explained that similar to U.S. nuclear strategy, deterrence of any kind of battle is the key goal in space. The Space Force, which would be responsible for organizing, training, and equipping military and civilian personnel, would be vital to that deterrence. The Space Force, said Vice President Mike Pence, will be a vanguard to defending our nation, defending our freedom, and defending the rights of all freedom-loving nations in the vast expanses of space.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.